Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio show and podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I am glad to be here. We are in the midst of running a long-running special edition. Do we know the name of it? Oh, yes, Think Like a Fighter Pilot. But before we get into that, a couple of administrative things right up front. Of course, we are a radio show on Red State Talk Radio, and we are a podcast on most of the podcast platform. Easy to find us, and we do this almost every week. It's a weekly podcast, and it's a weekend show on Red State Talk Radio, good radio station. Highly recommend it. Okay, so we are in the midst of a long-term discussion. Now, I'm gonna frame the argument this way. We have a very famous movie that has erupted, has presented itself to the general public. It's called Top Gun Maverick. It's a follow-on to the original Top Gun movie. Now, Top Gun Maverick is widely popular. But there's a lot of things about it that need to be considered from a critical thinking standpoint, and this show is all about critical thinking. And this is an opportunity for us, for all of us, opportunity for us on this end of the microphone, and an opportunity for all of us to consider, maybe even carefully consider, some of the things that were said, some of the things that were done with respect to the Top Gun Maverick movie, and what exactly is going on in the life of a fighter pilot. What exactly is it that we should understand? Let's get through the glory part of it and into the substantive examination of what goes on in the brain or the consciousness of a fighter pilot. And why do we need to know that? Can't we just get on with our daily lives and enjoy the movie from an entertainment standpoint? And sure, we could do that. I would recommend that we do a little bit more thoughtful examination and thoughtful analysis of this very, very popular movie, because it did strike a chord with the general population. We want to understand why that is. And is it something that we can use in our daily lives? My thesis, or my, what can I say? My position, point of view, or my reason for being is that we can learn from certain specialties and certain disciplines and certain warrior groups. We can learn from them. We can learn how they think, not what they think, but how they think. We can learn from them. And we can also learn how we should think, and how we should reason. So let's get right into this thing, and let's start off with a great question again from my amazing audio engineer. She helps me every week on this show, and she's going to propose present this question, and I will try to answer it. Here goes.
Well, hello, Kevin, and hello to your listening audience. Okay, you are proposing a radical idea. That is, if you want to perform well, you must first remove and replace much of your intellectual equipment with that which will optimize performance when performing a high-stakes operation. Can you explain this a little more for our listening audience? Thanks.
Okay, yes. Be glad to do that. And this leads right into what we're trying to address during this show this week, which is this radical idea, all right? And it is radical, but of course, this is the whole point of this show, this long-running show, is that we don't employ conventional thinking and conventional wisdom. We stress and emphasize and encourage and almost insist, yeah, maybe insist, that we all learn how to think critically, improve our ability to think critically. And I'm going to go a little bit beyond that in this show and other shows as well, which is, I want all of us to think critically. I also want all of us to reason conceptually. Now, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean we just bring our intellectual equipment to the operation that we normally have? Or do we have to do something about the way we think or how we think? We have to do something in preparation for our desire to perform well. Okay, so are we all performance-oriented people? Hopefully we are. You know, we live our lives, we do things that are productive and beneficial and helpful. We try to encourage prosperity and so forth and so on. We often are engaged in some kind of a business operation or a military operation. Now, I started my life right after graduating from the university. I started my life as a member of the military, so I learned a lot about military operations early on, and I stayed in the military for quite a long period of time, so I got involved in lots of military operations, and then eventually got into commercial aviation and learned a lot about business operations as well. Okay, so I am proposing that we replace our intellectual equipment that we have been given. Now, remember, there's something important here to remember, okay? So there is a, you know, there's a cultural, societal imperative here. There is a formal educational program set up in our culture and our society. The educational program ought to be teaching us how to think and coming up with the answers from that perspective. Unfortunately, that's not the way it actually is working. So you can say that our educational and training systems are flawed. Is that correct? Am I saying that? Actually, I am. I'm saying that our educational and training systems are, in fact, flawed. That's not really what the purpose ought to be. That's not actually how to address oneself to training the consciousness of a human. Okay. So, I am proposing a radical idea. If we want to engage in something meaningful, let's say that we're not talking about casual activities. We're not talking about getting up in the morning and yawning and then just sort of like muddling through a day without any purpose or meaning, just kind of a random set of activities and actions. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about people that are actually driven to do something. Okay, we're talking about people who... we can say, okay, I represent that group of people who are action-oriented. Okay, we are. We take action. We perform. We do things. We build things. We create things. We construct things. Okay, that is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people that do that, or I'm talking about people to aspire to do that. I'm talking about those who are just entering the workforce. I'm talking about those that are in the workforce. And then I'm talking to those who have retired from the workforce, but still function in the area of being a mentor or a coach or a supporter of those that have come after us. That's what I'm talking about. All right, so I'm actually talking about those, the performance class, a group of people who actually go out there and do something. And they're not just a bunch of complainers. They are actually doers. We're out there. We're doing something. We're building something. We're building up a business. We are performing a military operation. We are involved in new military concepts, new operational ideas and concepts related to performing certain warfare specialties. We're talking about developing a high level of expertise within a particular warfare community. The warfare community that I belonged to when I was in the military as a naval aviator, the warfare community I belonged to was aerial combat. Okay, that was my warfare specialty. I was a specialist. But having said that, that was a specialty that was still growing in understanding, still evolving. So I got in the primarily on the ground floor of high speed, close in aerial combat. That was my performance arena, and that was my combat specialty, high velocity, close in aerial combat. That warfare category or warfare group was still evolving, still developing, not least of which was the creation of the Navy Fighter Weapons School based at Naval Air Station Miramar, California, as explained in some form or fashion in both Top Gun movies. Okay. Miramar, and of course there was North Island for the Top Gun Maverick movie and stuff like that. All right, so I am proposing a radical idea. Okay, I'm just going to come right out and say it. Okay, the intellectual equipment that we have installed in our consciousness is probably and almost certainly suboptimum with respect to giving us the prerequisites and giving us the capabilities to perform well under high-stakes operations. And so, if we want to perform well under high-stakes operations or when performing high-stakes operations, if we want to perform well, if we want to optimize our performance, if we want to engage in performance optimization, what exactly do we do? We start off right away. We do not start off with procedures. We do not start off with procedure manuals. Okay, we start off by recognizing that we are not going to be thought followers. Okay, we reject that idea. All right, now, having said that, we are probably going to become familiar with procedures that have been developed by people other than us. Okay, we probably are. All right, so that's good, but that is insufficient. To be a thought leader, we have to look beyond the procedures. We have to look beyond the conventional. We have to look beyond what we have been given and engage in innovation and creativity right up front, or at least have the idea that we are going to be innovative and we are going to be creative. We're going to take a look at all of this stuff that we have right now and project that into the future and look at what would it take for us to perform in an optimum way some point in the future. Okay, so that's what we're going to be doing. Okay, another way of saying that is we're going to look at a set of We're going to predict a future situation from a set of current events. All right. So this projection, this prediction, this insight that we are attempting to develop is the key to what we would consider to be mission success. All right. What is the key to mission success? The key to mission success is innovation and creativity. That's the key to mission success. Is the key to mission success following procedures? Be aware of what the procedures are. Okay, don't be ignorant of the procedures. Be aware of it, but following procedures is not going to lead to mission success. All right. There is some preconditions by which we can justify acquiring the knowledge of what the procedures are, if in fact there are procedures. But we're not going to just blindly follow the procedures. We're not going to do that. Okay. Now, if you are looking at carefully examining the Top Gun Maverick movie, right, that was the bone of contention. That was the big thing. You were just slightly under the surface, but the big debate going on was, are we going to follow procedures blindly, or are we going to consider other things as well? Okay. Maverick wanted to consider other things as well, and he was not willing to go into the arena, this high-stakes operation, just following procedures. If you remember, he submitted a proposal to lower the deck. Okay, lower the hard deck. Why? Well, because the hard deck, while it has value, it was not going to permit this kind of high-stakes operations from, it was not going to allow this high-stakes operation to be successful, right? So we had to go beyond the procedures. We had to go beyond the hard deck, if you will. Hard deck is an actual place. It's also a metaphor. All right. Metaphorically, it was, are we going to look at the procedures as guidelines but not rules and laws? Okay. Are we going to open ourselves up to innovation and creativity? Yes, we are. Okay. Now, here's the big challenge for us. And I guess this is the point that I'm trying to get across, which is, okay, if we are going to prepare ourselves to perform well when we are conducting meaningful, purposeful, and a high-stakes operation, could be business or could be military, are we going to bring our already installed intellectual equipment with us, or are we going to replace it with something that is better and more appropriate for the situation? Now, my position is that we should have already known that this option existed or does exist. We should have already known that. Now, why in the world didn't we know that until we saw the Top Gun Maverick movie and it began to stimulate our intellect? Why did we not know that before? Okay, so what is the Top Gun Maverick movie doing? Is it entertaining? Yes, of course. But it's doing something more than that. It's stimulating our intellect. It's questioning our conventional wisdom. Okay. It is out there and saying, oh, by the way, you believe that you can think well right now in this time and place. And you probably can't. You probably don't think very well. So the first order of business, the prerequisite to being successful, the precondition by which you can achieve optimum performance when performing a high-stakes operation is that you must replace your intellectual equipment with that which is better suited for these kinds of operations. Now, what exactly are you faced with when you are performing a high-stakes operation? You're faced with three critical things. Three key aspects of reality are going to present themselves right square in your face, and you better be recognize, you better be aware of it. The first thing that's going to you are going to be faced with is time compression or increased time compression. Okay. Things are very, very dynamic, all right? We're talking about a dynamic system. We're talking about systems dynamics. Forrester is the person to go to there in terms of systems dynamic theory. Not sure I said that exactly right, but that's close enough. Okay, the first order of business is time compression. The second order of business is the things are going to be complex. All right, it just is. And so we recognize the existence of complexity, and we recognize the need to understand complexity theory. And the third thing that's going to happen is we are going to be faced with an uncertain world. Okay, what does that mean? It means that certitude is impossible now. All right, so we just got to get away from that notion. Certitude is impossible. We are now operating under conditions of uncertainty. What does that mean? We have two choices then, fundamentally. If we are operating under conditions of uncertainty, we can either just go into it on an ad hoc basis in a knee-jerk reaction and guess. Okay, or we can apply some analytics of uncertainty to elevate our thinking above just pure guesswork. Is there a way to do that? Yes, there is. In most cases, we've never been taught to do that. I don't know why. That's a very, very interesting question. Okay. There's a line in a movie, and then there's a action in the Top Gun Maverick movie. Okay, these two things work together, and I want you to be very careful to consider both of these things together. The first thing is the line in the movie, "Don't think, do." Okay, that was said two or three times in the movie. The second thing is the action. What action took place that relates directly to that phrase or that assertion, "Don't think, do." The action was that Maverick, Tom Cruise, put the procedures manual in the trash can. Okay, what was he doing? That was a metaphor for we are not going to succeed here just by knowing and following procedures. We have to go beyond that, and we have to become thought leaders. We have to employ higher order reasoning in order for us to achieve mission success. Okay, that's what we are dealing with. Okay, now, in order to prepare ourselves for these high-stakes operations, the stress involved and the complexity and the uncertainty. In order for us to do that, we have to be willing to replace what currently occupies our mind space with that which will improve our ability to perform under these conditions. Okay. Now, I've got a little bit of time here. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to read you, read all of us, a thing that I just wrote, and this, it's a very short article. I think it's a 2-minute or a 3-minute read or something like that. And I have a Substack account, if you will, or a better way of saying that is I have a Substack channel, and I post short articles and short videos on this on my Substack account. All right, so I have I have an author account with this platform called Substack. It's actually quite popular and growing in popularity, and it's kind of like an alternative form of communication. Very well received. And so, yes, I have a Substack channel, or I have a Substack account. It's under the what is my Substack account? It's under the Sonic Warrior. Yeah, it's under the Sonic Warrior banner, is my Substack account. And so I post a, typically I will have a short article posted, available on Substack every week. Right, it's a kind of a weekly thing, and it ties in with the Throttle Up Radio Show and ties in with some of the other things that I'm doing as well. All right, so I'm going to read this because this is kind of like sets the stage for a long-term discussion about what I'm trying to propose and what I am proposing and what I'm trying to deal with, and trying to understand exactly what we should be doing, not what we are doing, but what we should be doing with respect to our ability to perform and do things. Okay, the title of this Substack series is called Velocity, and this is episode number eight. Subtitle of this is Time Compression. Time compression is one of the greatest challenges that we have ever encountered. Now, it goes on. So I'm going to read this. Incredibly, this challenge was addressed in the Top Gun Maverick movie with the phrase, "Don't think, do." When performing high-velocity aerial combat at a certain point in the velocity spectrum, time compression will occur. In order to function, perform, and achieve in this reality, all of the intellectual equipment that we have acquired, or more accurately, that has been taught to us by others, must be replaced. Otherwise, mission failure is the likely outcome. Now, that's a bold statement I just made, okay? But we're not, but I guess you could say the Throttle Up is known for its bold statements, okay? I'll continue. We do not stop thinking. What we do is replace our intellectual equipment with a new set of stress-tested equipment, which is optimized for increased time compression events. Now, to be clear, to clarify, the term time compression, or more accurately, increased time compression, is a condition in which the time available to perform the activity is less than the time actually required to perform the activity due to the realities of velocity. under such velocity-intensive conditions unless a solution is immediately forthcoming. Mission failure will occur. But again, in the Top Gun Maverick movie, if the required time on target is 3 minutes or less, the corresponding velocity must be, in the real world, above 450 knots. In a low-level, high-speed world, increased time compression occurs at or above 450 knots. Therefore, velocity, I'm saying parenthetically here, therefore, velocity and time compression relate to one another. Okay, at a certain point in the mission, time compression will occur, and normal thinking, by the way, is not going to work. I'm just going to come right out and say that from experience. Normal thinking, or the way that we normally think, is simply not going to work now. Okay, so we got to either we experience mission failure and say, well, we can't do this, it's impossible, or we come up with a solution. Let me continue reading. Consequently, all fighter pilots capable of functioning under conditions of increased time compression replace all of their intellectual equipment with a new set of intellectual equipment robust enough to function properly when time compression occurs. I realize that for some, what I'm proposing is outrageous. But keep in mind J.B.S. Haldane's proposition. The universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can imagine. Going further, this is the problem statement that all fighter pilots live by. So I'm going to read this now. Unless decisive action is quickly taken during mission-critical time-compressed events, risk will continue to rise to a point beyond which catastrophe occurs. Such a point is called the critical event horizon. Do not operate beyond the critical event horizon. In order to avoid the critical event horizon and subsequent mission failure, our intellectual equipment that we have installed in our mind space is contained within the category that can best be described as probabilistic conceptualism. Such equipment enables one to employ abstract higher order thinking and reasoning in which abstraction hierarchies and abstract clustering are under immediate consideration. Conceptualization takes center stage. Conceptual constructs are created and employed, often within a matter of seconds or microseconds. And I will say here, parenthetically, that Aristotle was right. We have consequently created a new order of things, and the human intellect is no longer data-driven, but now becomes event-driven, and the clarification of the event becomes vital. In closing, I know that the above statement may very well be a shock to some, perhaps to many. Okay, I can say that, well, welcome to the new intellectual frontier. As always, respectful comments are welcome. All right, so that is the end of the Substack short piece article on under the Sonic Warrior channel, if you will, of Substack. And that's the point that I'm trying to make here as well, is that we have to replace our intellectual equipment and we have to employ that which comes under the category of conceptualism. We have to think conceptually. We have to train our brains to think first and foremost conceptually, and to avoid the tendency, but the disastrous practice of thinking in terms of data sets. We are not a data-driven system. Our cognitive system is not data-driven, okay? It should be event-driven, and we should never think in terms of data sets. We should always think in terms of conceptualism. All right, so we've got one more thing to do before we close this this segment of Throttle Up. What are we doing? We're doing an audio clip from How to Be a Hero, The Psychology of Heroism from the Academy of Ideas, a great place to go to get some really great information. And that this is again, I'm promoting this whole idea of thinking outside the box and thinking critically. And this is a good piece of how we should also do that as well if we want to be heroes. Here goes.
We need a great rebirth of the heroic in our world. Every sector of human society, wherever that may be on the planet, seems to be slipping into an unconscious chaos. The 19th century American poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said that fame is the fragrance of heroic deeds. But this is no longer the case in the modern world. Fame, in our day, is foisted primarily upon celebrities and politicians, two classes of individuals for whom the word heroic rarely applies. And so, if, as the ancient Greeks believed, a people are known by the idols they worship, then it is safe to say the spirit of heroism has all but vanished from the modern world. If on the off chance a true hero does emerge in the public's view, many respond with envy, and fixate on the hero's flaws and weaknesses, on the fact that their feet are made of clay. Ours is not an age that wants heroes. Ours is an age of envy, in which laziness and self-involvement are the rule. Anyone who tries to shine, who dares to stand above the crowd, is dragged down by his lackluster and self-appointed peers. But in choosing to venerate celebrities, politicians, or else comic book and movie characters, and not real heroes of the flesh and blood, we do ourselves a great disservice. For not only do we inhibit the rise of the heroes that could help push back against the chaos the world is slipping into, but we also diminish our own urge to heroism, an urge that is fundamental to psychological health. Or as the 20th century cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker put it, in our culture anyway, especially in modern times, the heroic seems too big for us, or we too small for it. Tell a young man that he is entitled to be a hero and he will blush. If everyone honestly admitted his urge to be a hero, it would be a devastating release of truth. But the truth about the need for heroism is not easy for anyone to admit. In the more passive masses of mediocre men, it is disguised as they humbly follow out the roles that society provides for their heroics and try to earn their promotions within the system, allowing themselves to stick out, but ever so little and so safely. In the hopes of witnessing a rebirth of the heroic and to push back against the envy-ridden who desire to keep us all on the same petty level of insignificance, we are going to examine the psychology of the hero. Specifically, we are going to investigate what true heroism consists of, how the potential to be a hero exists in each of us, and how we can satiate our own heroic urge. To understand the hero, we must first understand the role of values in the hero's life. For above all else, a heroic life is a life lived in the service of values. To live a valued life, writes Stephen Hayes, is to act in the service of what you value. It was Bob Dylan who wrote, "You've got to serve somebody. The question is, who or what will you serve?" We all have to live in the service of something. If we don't, we are like a ship without a rudder, and the course of our life will be pushed and pulled by forces external to us. We can live in the service of another person. We can live in the service of an institution or ideology, or we can construct a self-chosen value system and live in the service of it. To choose the latter course means to make a judgment as to what we deem to be worthy of struggling for and protecting. It requires that we reflect on the question, what does the good life consist of for me? To arrive at an answer, we can build on the wisdom of others. We can look to role models for inspiration. But ultimately, we must select what it is we believe will move us in the direction of a greater life. The things we settle upon become the components of our value system, and as a few examples, we may choose to value freedom, truth, beauty, friendship, temperance, love. We may value a specific pastime or craft, or in the words of the author Andrew Bernstein, an individual might value education or career in a specific field, or a particular man or woman, or children, or any and all of the above, or one of numerous other possibilities. But whatever his or her values, these are the things, persons, or activities he considers most important in life. Values advance life. They never obstruct or harm it. But as fallible creatures, we can be misguided as to what we judge to be a value. The drug addict, for example, believes he values another hit. The alcoholic, another drink. The tyrant, more power over others. The envious, destruction for its own sake. But in such cases, the object of desire is harmful to our well-being or to that of others, and so, it is not a value but an evil that tends towards suffering and death. Values can also become corrupted with time. Some things that are valuable at one stage of life lose their life-promoting quality at another stage. And so, in constructing our value system, we must be critical regarding what we choose. For as Socrates noted long ago, ignorance is, in many cases, a greater cause of suffering than evil intentions. Building on this brief elucidation of the nature and significance of values, we can now integrate this knowledge to better understand what it means to be a hero, or as Bernstein explains, loyalty in action, regardless obstacles or challenges, to one's most cherished values. This is the essence of moral rectitude, and it is the foundation of heroism. The hero is the individual whose commitment to values far exceeds that of normality, and whose value system serves human well-being on a mass scale. The hero may dedicate his or her life to justice, to ameliorate the effects of human evil, to innovation to enhance standards of living, to knowledge to alleviate suffering, or to freedom to combat tyranny and promote social cooperation. In practical terms, heroes place mankind on their supportive shoulders and carry human beings into flourishing civilization. Contrary to a common belief, heroism does not involve self-sacrifice. Heroism is not a zero-sum game in which the hero serves as a benefactor of mankind but suffers personally as a result. Rather, in remaining committed to the values that move human beings towards greater flourishing, the hero simultaneously advances his or her own life goals in quest for self-realization, or as Bernstein puts it, there is a widespread belief that heroism involves not self-fulfillment but its antipode, self-sacrifice. Such a belief is false, even pernicious. Heroes are a subcategory of morally upright persons. Morally upright persons do not sacrifice themselves. As a practical point, it is an individual's genuine self-fulfillment that benefits others, not his or her self-sacrifice. As the hero lives in a manner that tends towards self-realization while also promoting the well-being of others, they are a rare specimen and in possession of some exceptional attributes. Foremost among these attributes is a dauntless commitment to their values. The hero is immune to the intimidation and discouragement that easily derails the unheroic. They face up to challenges rather than cowering from them. And if powerful destructive forces cross their path, the hero responds with great courage and, if necessary, engages with these forces in an epic battle of David versus Goliath proportions. They may be exhausted, but they persevere. They may be fearful, but they face danger courageously. They may be both exhausted and fearful, but they do not quail in the face of obstacle and or danger. Heroes are undeterred by profoundly intractable problems and or by dangerously potent antagonists. In the face of either or both, they are undaunted. The next attribute shared by all heroes is the possession of some form of extraordinary talent and skill, be it intellectual, bodily, or moral. But this towering capacity of ability possessed by the hero introduces a problem. If the unique combination of nature and nurture that drove our development did not bestow us with the intellect of a Carl Jung, a creative knack like Nikola Tesla, or the moral fortitude and resilience of a Socrates or Frederick Douglass, can we still be heroes? To answer this question and save heroism from becoming a caste system one is either born and nurtured into or forever excluded, Bernstein introduces the concept of the demihero. For just as mythology is populated with gods and demigods, the latter being half mortal and half god, so too are there degrees of heroism. The vast majority of us may lack the motivation or ability to shape the course of history, but all of us have the potential to be a demihero within the sphere of our own life. And this can be accomplished by first cultivating a value system and then committing to staying on course, even when the obstacles that confront us are immense. Each day thereafter, we will be faced with a choice that will determine the degree to which we will taste heroism. We can, like the ancient Greek Odysseus, persevere in the midst of toil and trouble and respond to danger with courage. Or we can, like the anti-hero, tap out of the battles of life, surrender to our inner demons, give up the values we hold dear, and succumb to a meaningless life. Heroism says, integrate those shadows or slay them. Put disaster behind you and get on with your life. Or as Bernstein writes, every man or every woman, in numerous forms and instances, seeks positive, life-enhancing values, is confronted by potent impediments and or opposition, refuses to sacrifice his or her goals, proceeds to struggle vigorously to the utmost of capacity, and, in numerous cases, overcomes obstacles and carries an arduous quest to successful resolution. Such actions are indubitably heroic. To grant us the strength to make the daily choice in favor of heroism, we can engage in the practice of hero worship. To practice hero worship, we need to seek out individuals, past or present, who displayed a heroic commitment to values similar to ours, and then we learn the obstacles they faced, the inner demons they battled, and the powerful adversaries they fought and defeated. In moments of solitude, we can reflect upon their struggles and their victories, and allow our emotions to rise into the ethers of inspiration. A hero worshiper experiences the highest emotions of which man is capable, a sense of the exalted. Experiences accompanied by strong emotions are deeply imprinted into our brain, and so, in experiencing a sense of the exalted while contemplating the lives of the heroes we admire, we fast-track our own heroic education. In the process, we add to our arsenal a great antidote to suffering. For whenever we are weighed down by the regressive forces within, we can choose a particular hero and ask ourselves the following questions. How would this hero respond to an intimidating obstacle in my life? After all, even in absence of the epic hero's degree of prowess, why cannot I respond with the dauntlessness and devotion to human life that a hero does? Why not, indeed? The answer, of course, is that a hero worshiper can. To live a heroic life in the service of self-chosen values is, in the modern day, to swim against the tide. For we live in an age when a widespread corruption of values has led the mass of men and women to gravitate toward distraction and empty pleasures. If we are going to be one of the few who counters this trend and rejects the sickness of modern-day conformity, we must be comfortable with going against the grain of the socially accepted. When the whole world is running towards a cliff, he who is running in the opposite direction appears to have lost his mind. To help us maintain our moral autonomy as we escape from the demoralizing hedonism of our age and move towards a life of heroic proportions, we can reflect on the wisdom of Arthur Schopenhauer, who claimed, "A happy life is impossible. The highest that man can achieve is a heroic life." In striving for heroism, in other words, we are not sacrificing a life of perpetual happiness, comfort, and pleasure, as such a life is not open to us. Instead, in dedicating our life to heroism, we are choosing the best life possible, a life that is meaningful, challenging, exciting. Or as Nietzsche wrote, "Alas, I have known noble men who lost their highest hope, and henceforth they slandered all high hopes. Henceforth they lived imprudently in brief pleasures, and they had hardly an aim beyond the day. Once they thought of becoming heroes, now they are sensualists. The hero is to them an affliction and a terror. But by my love and hope, I entreat you, do not reject the hero in your soul. Keep holy your highest hope.
Okay, yes. You know, that was really great. Wasn't that a great piece by the folks, great folks at the Academy of Ideas? I recommend them, and we use their stuff quite a bit. Great piece on heroism. I am proposing the same thing, basically, when I say remove and replace your intellectual equipment. That's kind of a heroic thing to do. You're not going along with the crowd. You're not thinking in terms of groupthink. You're thinking for yourself. You know, to be a thought leader is also to be a hero. I think the two of those go to hand in glove. Wouldn't you say that? I'm asking this of my audio engineer. Yes, they both go together very well. So to be a hero is to also be a thought leader, and I'm proposing that we create more thought leaders. That's my proposition here. Being a thought leadership is not just for a select few. We should all strive to be thought leaders and be willing to dump the procedures manual when it is appropriate to do so, and to begin to think for ourselves. In order for us to do such a thing, my proposal is, that we have to first and foremost swap out our intellectual equipment with that which is better suited for the world of a thought leader and the world of a hero. If we want to be that, then we have to have the right equipment at our disposal. How much time do I have?
10 seconds.
I have 10 seconds to go. All right. Well, thank you for listening. That's another Throttle Up Radio Show and podcast, and we'll see you all next week.